Hey, good evening. Welcome to the Conventional Sniper Podcast. I'm your spotter, Justin Colletti. So tonight, I know normally we do like a week between podcasts, or I try to, but I'm up at my buddy Rob's house. He's been on the podcast before. So Rob, welcome back to the podcast. I appreciate you being on here.
Always love being here.
So tonight we're just hanging out up at your house, and we've had a few beers, and we're relaxing and catching up on some old times. We decided that we're gonna drink and podcast, which is probably a recipe for disaster. But you know, as the basics say, live and let learn. So
guns ballistics, and beers.
Yeah, gun ballistics and beers. So anyway, I digress. Let's knock out the S2 brief here for a few seconds. So again, I told you guys in the last podcast about the upcoming Toyota War. We'll discuss that. That's in relation to the history of the technical vehicle and its role in combat and proxy wars throughout the country. I didn't really go too much in depth in that last time, but that's basically what it is. And it has a really interesting history. So shout out to Toyota for being the modern vehicle of warfare. But
yeah, I've fought out of those things. Those are awesome.
They're great. But anyway, we'll get into that into another podcast, which will be here in the next week or so. It'll be after this one, obviously. And then also, again, just to reiterate, I will be at Sniper School next week for the graduation of the upcoming class. So if you're a stud down there, make sure you stay focused. I know you guys got some stocks and record fires coming up, and you know, shoot straight, aim small, miss small. And also, I want to give a quick shout-out again to Gray Fox Industries. And I want to just for a second be transparent and clear about their product. I happen to find them on Instagram on my own. I happen to like the patch that's there. It's a memorial patch. It's a tri-cornered flag, essentially, with like a red space underneath the stars that allow you to write in someone's name that you want to memorialize. It doesn't necessarily have to be someone who's directly killed in combat. It can be anyone you want. So I just happen to like those patches. I buy them on my own, and I hand them out to everyone that I can. I just think the patches are great. So shout out to those guys for making a good patch. And
I have several.
Yeah, I've given you some. I've given some out to some of the guys that I see in the VA. You know, I just had some VA appointments and gave some out randomly. Some dudes in there that are older Korean War and Vietnam vets. So if you're looking to, you know, kind of memorialize someone in just a special way, those patches are great. And those patches, again, they go on Velcro, but they're kind of like the GWAT veteran era, you know? You've got the older generations that have their saucer caps that are part of the VFW, but our newer generations that wear ball caps with morale patches. And that's kind of, you know, to me, a more professional way to memorialize and carry someone's name. So
I put mine up in the the visor of my truck.
Yeah, I've got some that go on my service dog's vest. I have some that are in my room. You know, like I've got them kind of all over the place. So again, thanks guys for those patches, and I just want to let everyone know that I bought that out of my own money, and I'm not sponsored by them. They don't give us a discount code, although, you know, maybe if they hear this, hopefully I can help some of you guys out. But they're just, you know, conversating with them, they're good dudes. So anyway, so as we were discussing our drunken shenanigans about the future of snipers in warfare as it pertains to the digital age, we just happened to be talking cartridge selection. And as many of you may know, SOCOM recently had their M110s rechambered in 6.5 Creedmoor. It's the first history, the first historic example of special forces units changing over from 308 to 6mm ish. And we'll get into a little bit about the history of 6mm and the unique metric versus non-metric conversions of 6mm. But one thing I want to back up on, well, first let's get into some terms. So in a barrel, specifically a firearms barrel, you have lands and grooves. And for those of you that don't know, lands and grooves are the technical makeup of rifling in a barrel. Those lands and grooves create spin on a bullet to stabilize it during flight. Now, within those lands and grooves, different militaries measure the space between the lands and the grooves differently.
Well, it's almost exclusively the British from what I've found. So So what I have found, I think I'm actually the one that taught most of the ballistic stuff for
most, like our section.
Most of the section stuff. So we'll take the British 303, for example.
Well, hold on. Before you go forward. So Lance, right? Let's talk about what is Lance versus Grooves.
So, yeah,
So the Lance are the thinnest point of where the rifling protrudes out from the basics of the barrel, right? So it's the Lance are the tallest point. The Grooves are the space that are closest to the actual construction of the barrel. Think of it as like a zipper.
The lands are actually what causes the spin.
Right, because that's the point that contacts the bullet.
Correct.
Where the grooves are spaces in between each land. Think of like a gear, right? And a gear has like...
the protruding point and the inner point.
And the inner point. So it's the space in between the protruding like...
So it has two diameters. It has the... inner diameter and the outer diameter.
Which is still, the outer diameter is still inside the barrel.
So, with that, the British are a little bit weird when it comes to this. So the 303 British.
Which has been used since World War, well, it had been used since World War One. That's when they first came up with the cartridge.
Yeah.
Was for their Enfields.
And we don't want to get too much into the 303 British, but everybody thinks, okay, 303... that's a 303. No. The 303 is actually unique. The 303 is actually 311. So
0.3.
Yes.
0.311.
Now, I'm going to slow this down so that people can kind of absorb a little bit of this. I don't want to get too technical because that's not what this is about. But you hear 308. Okay, 308 is 0.308 inches. It is equal to 7.62 inches. Okay? Now,
what we're talking about is the outermost diameter of the bullet.
Yes. So, 303 British is actually not 0.303 inches, it's actually 0.311. So it's actually, in metric terms, instead of being 7.62, it's actually 7.7. So it's a larger caliber. If you're trying to take a British 303 and reload that round into a 308 casing, if you're a reloader, you would find out very quickly it isn't going to fit. So, there we go. I have brought you up in as Barney style as I can. There are two dimensions to a barrel, the inner and outer. The British are like the only ones that actually measure, to my knowledge.
But the British measure to the grooves, not to the lands.
Yeah, they measure that smaller one for some reason.
Well, technically it's the larger diameter because it actually contacts the inner space between each land.
Yeah, they give the smaller diameter for the, even though the... So when we measure, we actually give you the actual measurement of the bullet.
Right.
They actually give you the measurement of the
lance. The space from the bullet to the lance.
So.
Or the grooves.
Exactly.
To the grooves.
They do it a little differently anyway, so you just got to be cognizant sometimes. It's kind of just a side note.
Well, I mean, the reason we got into this was we were discussing the FAL versus the M14 and cartridge selection, and everyone knows, at least most people know, that the FN-FAL is known as the right arm of the free world, right? It's supposed to be like the battle rifle to end all battle rifles.
It is absolutely a beautiful rifle, and it should have been implemented across the world. It should have been everything, but you know what? Unfortunately, due to
politics,
an individual,
that individual is Colonel Rene Studler. So he worked for the U.S. Army's Small Arms Development Organization. And him, after the war, he was kind of like, hey, I need to kind of, you know, put my mark on the world and piss on this fire hydrant and mark my territory. So as looking back through history, every army in the world has realized that the intermediate cartridge, stemming from the Stungewehr 44 or the STG 44 from the Germans in World War II, is the way forward in firearms development.
Okay, so in real dummy terms, we're talking, call it roughly a 30 caliber.
A caliber. There's a B in there, bud.
And there's a lot of B in me, too.
A lot of beer.
Call it about a 30 caliber beer. Beer. Call it about a 30 caliber. But in a medium-sized casing, not quite as large as a 308 casing. But not as small as a 30 carbine casing.
Well, it's still, I mean, both of they're still 30 caliber in diameter.
So, example, and I don't want to spoil anything moving forward, but 7.62, 308, same caliber, in a shorter casing, so the 308 in a shorter casing, change a few things out here and there, you've basically got the 7.62 by 50, or by 39R.
You're talking about 7.62 by 39.
By 39, right. Which is the AK-47 round, for those that you just don't speak gun.
Or speak metric versus non-metric.
Basically.
So all cartridges are either...
intermediate round.
Right, so all cartridges are either... all bullets are either measured in metric or non-metric. Which makes me beg the question, like, which came first? The development of metric versus non-metric for... Or I guess the terminology was there for bullets, or was it there for mechanics? Like, we're gonna have to figure this out in podcasts, because if you look at this in the long run, there's tons of things that have come up in civilian life that were originally invented by the military. Example: the World Wide Web, the internet.
GPS.
Yeah, GPS. The internet was designed by the military. So, it makes me wonder if these differences in measurements came from the need for militaries to describe things differently, which, knowing what I know about research and design and development and prototyping, my last assignment being the Natick Research and Development Center, it makes me scratch my head and go, is this a trick thing that I don't really know about yet? That measurements really comes from this? But anyway, that's a future cool podcast. Anyway, I digress. So in cartridge selection, it's either measured in metric or non-metric. Everyone in Europe, outside of the military, or outside of the United States military, uses metric.
And then you've got basically underpowered, medium powered, and high powered. So,
or like Magnum cartridges.
Yeah, and what the world was saying right about the 1950s was we need roughly a 30 caliber in a medium powered cartridge.
That logistically,
so Colonel
Rene Studler
was trying to make his mark, and you know what? This is your story. You feel
all right. So yeah, so this guy's basically like, hey, you know, I need to make my mark, and part of his requirements were that any future cartridge or gun design needs to be able to use at least half of the tooling from the M1 Garand. Which
85%.
Which, I mean, let's give it to the guy for a second. That's genius. Why are you going to make the entire United States military, which supports the Navy, the Marine Corps, the Army Air Corps, and the Army, change all of their tooling to design, manufacture, and produce firearms on a mass scale to meet a new firearms and cartridge development?
This is 1950 when we're already a world power.
Logistically, it makes sense because we've produced so many firearms. It would cost, I mean, if we translated the difference, you know, between how much we had on inventory, what it would cost us, if we came up to the current day standards, it would cost billions of dollars to change all this tooling, right? Not to mention going through logistics of who owns the right to this tooling, who's going to manufacture these guns, you know, who's going to create this solicitation. That's a huge endeavor. So I got to give it to the guy for a second to say he's forward-thinking in that respect. He's thinking about where can we put our most bang, no pun intended here, for our buck. Where does it come from? Well, it comes from we already have the tooling, So why don't we go to cartridge selection? And the idea of the M14 was it was supposed to replace the M1 Garand, the Browning automatic rifle, the M1 carbine, and the Thompson submachine gun. We're supposed to replace all of that because logistically, it's three different cartridges, 30-06, 30 carbine, and 45. So logistically, the Army's getting screwed on shipping all the stuff around.
Oh, God, they're buying stuff from everything. Yeah, and that's the problem across the world is that they've got all these new NATO countries that have,
random cartridges.
Different countries shooting 200 different cartridges, and they're trying to all come together.
Right. So hence why NATO was formed, right? So NATO says, hey, we want to standardize one cartridge. So the British do a crap ton of testing, and they come out with what essentially is 280 British, right?
Yeah, which is a 7.2 millimeter or 0.284 inches.
Right. So they take all of this stuff, and knowing politics of the day and this guy wanting his cartridge, essentially America agrees behind closed doors that they're going to work with Belgium, specifically FN, and they're going to adopt the FAL over the M14 so long as the FAL is chambered in 308 or 7.62. We know that 284 British is more ballistically sound than 308.
280 British, that's why we got into the earlier thing about the 280 or 284 barreling. Yeah, but 280 British, Travis.
Right, yeah. So basically, they're going to adopt 308. Well, America didn't really hold true to its word, and instead the M14 ends up getting adopted, and thus troops in Vietnam end up with the M14, which is just a magazine-fed Garand. At its core, is a magazine-fed Garand. But even during World War II, they had examples of the M1 Garand magazine-fed. Winchester, for example, produced a prototype of a magazine-fed M1 Garand. And now, the gas system and how it was regulated was different than what the M14 ended up being. The M14 is still adjustable with its gas system. The M1 Garands and their prototypes were not. And they actually used BAR magazines, the Browning Automatic Rifle. They took the Browning Automatic Rifle magazines because, logistically, they're already in stock. So they took those magazines and adapted it to the M1 Garands, and thus, that was the beginning of the M14 cycle. Well, now,
before the 14, they also had the, and I'm drawing a blank on the name, the carbine.
Talking about the 30 carbine?
The 30 carbine. Well, yeah,
the 30.
It looks very, very, very similar to the 14, which is still magazine fed and all that. But
it's actually completely different from the M1 Garand and the M14.
Manufacturing wise, it's actually totally different.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But it looks very, very similar.
So if you look at kind of like examples of carbines, for example, the Paratrooper M1 carbine, the bolt, the top of the bolt is flat. And that has a folding stock.
I'm just saying, in general concept, when you're looking at these things, when you're taking an American concept of a firearm, and then you overlay it to the FNAL.
Yeah, the FAL.
That were actually at the same time trying to bury the colonel is trying to bury to promote his career, like an.
That's almost like every general officer.
They're two completely different guns. It basically looks like a segue between the Grand and the 14. So you can almost see that segue before the 14 even existed.
Talking about for the FAL?
So, no, for that mini 30, the 30 carbine.
Existed, I get you. I get you. Kind of see what you're saying.
14. So you can kind of see where he thought that
took some firearms design
where he
tips
kind
from.
Of thought that 14.
I get what you're saying. Well, the thing. So there's some unique differences with the M1 carbine. So the M1 carbine was way more overproduced than the M1 Grand was. Like billions, well not billions, but millions of copies of the M1 Carbine were sold in comparison to the Garands. And the Thompsons are even less, because back in the day the Thompsons were an expensive piece of, quote, machinery.
Well, it had a lot of parts to it. It was a pain in the ass to take it apart. Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, in modern day manufacturing, the upper receiver to the Thompson is considered the full auto portion for transferable firearms. So I can take a full auto lower for a Thompson submachine gun, and it's not an NFA item. Where versus the upper receiver, because the dimensions are different between the semi-auto and the full auto, and one's open bolt versus closed bolt, the actual NFA item is the upper receiver to the Thompson. So when you look at the M1 carbines, there are two big, like, immediately stark, well, I guess three. One is fixed stock versus folding stock, right? And the issue, or I should say the issue, but the other noticeable piece between the guns is the bolt being flat versus curved, right? So the fixed stock versions have a curved bolt, meaning circular, like the upper portion is circular, versus the paratrooper versions, the bolt is actually flat. It's flush with the top of the receiver, where the stocked ones, the non-folding stocks, they're actually circular and sit slightly above the receiver, along where the guide rails are.
And these are just minor cosmetic things, and I'm just saying that from the M1 Grand, then you, a few years later, come out with the carbine. Now you're looking for that new rifle. Europe is saying, oh, we've got this FNAL. It's the greatest thing since sliced bread. It comes in the 280 British. Everybody is loving this round. I mean, we've got experts from every field. We've got people coming in from literally around...
Every ballistician, which is a ballistic expert.
Yeah, every ballistician's coming in. Everybody's coming in and saying, look, dude, Colonel.
280 British.
280 British. Bro. 280 British, man. Like, nothing is outperforming this.
And he's like, hey, I need to make General.
And he's like, gotta make General. I gotta make a name for myself. So we ended up dropping back onto the good old fashioned M1 Grand kind of looking, sort of. We pulled something out of our hat. Let's make...
Let's save a few bucks and still stay with the historic, like, hunting battle rifle.
Yeah, and 85% of our machining was the requirement.
And we're going to make a magazine fed and full auto.
Oh, yeah, yeah, but that too. Add that. And if somebody's got a star hanging around in a nice presentation box,
yeah, for if me, you guys can go ahead and put in my award, it'd be great. Matter of fact, let's do an administrative promotion. That'd be perfect.
So, yeah, anyway, that's how we ended up with the 14 instead of the FNAL.
Which, if you look at the designs of the 14s and the FAL, they're piston-driven, right? So, I mean, you can get in, and I don't want to get in the weeds too much of short-stroke versus long-stroke piston systems, but essentially, piston system is literally what it is. It's a piston, well, right? Combustion pushes a rod. The rod rotates, you know, it is connected to the bolt, and the bolt cycles.
Let's be dead honest. We have been dead in the water for, like, the past, what, 120 years in firearms technology. We have essentially two styles of firearms?
Three.
Go ahead and explain.
Direct impingement, which is gas is cycled through a gas block into a tube, right? And then the gas pushes down the tube into a gas key, which is connected to the carrier, the bolt carrier.
Okay, and where does that originate from? Which firearm?
That would be like the Eugene Stoners, the AR-10s. It's the M16 style of firearms. That was the first guy to really push in direct impingement.
Okay, and then previous to
and
that.
Then you've got piston-driven and direct blowback. So piston-driven originates from Browning, which if you don't know who Browning is, he's probably like the most influential.
If you don't know who Browning is, just hang up now. Don't continue. Just
hit the Google machine. Like, that's a whole nother podcast in itself, man. So Browning, essentially, he figures out one day, and I'm going to give this the quick synopsis to this. He figures out one day when he's hunting, or not hunting, but skeet shooting with his kids with shotguns, all this extra gas that's protruding from the barrel. And he realizes, like, holy moly, I'm wasting energy. So why not go back to my shop and push this gas somewhere? So and I forget the actual designation of the machine gun, but he comes out essentially what American troops begin to call the potato masher. And essentially where the gas tube is, there's this lever that's pushed down by gases that cycle a piston to the rear. And so this gas pushes the lever down. And if the lever on the gas tube is too low to the ground, it digs up the ground and flings dirt everywhere. So that's how it became known as the potato masher. So fast forward a little bit, now you have the Browning automatic rifle, which is a piston-driven system, or what would be, I guess, considered a long stroke, right? It has a really long action. But the important part of the BAR that most people are forgetting, and Reed Knight will agree with this, I've heard him say this, that the reason why the BAR is such a reliable weapon system, other than the fact that it's piston-driven, is the bolt face has time to recess into the carrier, dropping the pressures in the chamber that allow the gun to cycle effectively. So you're bleeding off air or gases in the chamber and unsealing it before the entire carrier system has even moved. So you're dropping pressures to a safe level to allow the system to completely reciprocate. And that's what makes the Browning automatic rifle so reliable, is that it allows gases to drop and expel from the system and unseal before the entire system even moves. Now, what most people don't realize, or at least that I know of, most people don't realize, is that the BAR has three gas settings. It basically has like shut off, a lot of gas, and normal gas. Now, Ohio ordnance in modern day times has the heavy counter assault rifle, which the heavy counter assault rifle is a modern day interpretation of the Polish WZ-28. Now, the Polish WZ-28 is a European, I guess, solicitation win from Browning. So after World War I, Poland realizes they have a bunch of different firearms and different calibers, like what we were talking about earlier, like, you know, difference between metric and non-metric and random things, like they have the Shoshot, they have the BAR, they have Maxims. And they wanted to standardize.
Yeah, it's kind of a shit show in their arms room.
It's more than a shit show. Because they basically get overrun by everyone. So they have, sorry, Poland. I know you have beautiful women, but I guess your country gets overrun all the time. because you're like, you're stuck with.
A beer.
Oh, man. Russia. Beer Germany.
Beer check.
Yeah, okay. So basically, they want to standardize all their machine guns and create a medium machine gun, what we would know as a squad automatic weapon. They wanted to not have a crew-served machine gun. They want to have one that one man can operate. So basically, they hold trials. France submits, Belgium submits on behalf of Browning.
Wait, France submits?
France submits with their Shoshot.
Wait. Did they submit as in surrender? Or?
No. They submitted a firearms designed to standardize Poland.
Oh, usually they submit, they just send up the white flag.
Fair enough.
Okay, just checking.
Their show shots were only dropped once. So, and they were probably painted white. So anyway, ironically, their country's color is white. Anyway, back then. So basically, they get through like 3 days of this trial, and Poland's like, nah, man, we're checking out the BAR. Everyone else can pound sand. So France gets really upset and is like, hey, no, dudes, you guys jacked up. Like, you didn't even finish the trial fairly. We want a retrial. So Poland's like, fine, whatever. We'll do basically a retrial. And guess who wins? The BAR.
Because it's the...
The best machine gun ever invented.
Invented ever.
Right. So, I mean, it's the modern design for the M 240. It's the modern design for the M60.
It's the modern design of firearms in general.
For piston-driven guns, the BAR is the design straight from Browning that started with the potato masher.
Like I started this segue with, like, that we have had a... We've staled. We're
done. So we're at the epitome of firearms design right now.
Somebody's just... to stop the stagnation.
I mean, there's been some Frankenstein modifications of different systems, but they're essentially all the same. Direct impingement, blowback, or piston, right? And we'll get into blowback later, but yeah, that's not really relevant for our conversation. Basically, the bolt has a fixed firing pin. It seals off the chamber. It uses recoil to generate the bolt back, and there's no gas heat, gas tube, or piston. That's essentially what it is. So Poland makes a few like conditions about them purchasing the BAR or the WZ-28. One, they wanted an 8mm Mauser because everyone around them is an 8mm Mauser, right? Which is like 7.92, I think. It's basically 8mm Mauser. What we know is 8mm Mauser is actually 7.92, which is what the Germans had their standard cartridge in, is 7.92 or 8mm. Okay? So Poland's like, we want an 8mm Mauser. Oh, by the way, your bipods, they suck on the BAR. We want new design bipods. You have no muzzle device on your gun, so we want a flash cone. So they put a flash cone on there. Oh, and by the way, because the gun's an 8mm Mauser, it recoils a little bit more, so we want to add a pistol grip. A pistol grip instead of having the BAR be a hunting sporting rifle.
Gooseneck.
Yeah. Right, so what? Basically, Poland is ahead of their time saying, hey, wait a second, if we add a pistol grip, it's more ergonomic for the shooter, thus allowing the gun to shoot flatter,
yeah,
versus having a goosenecked or regular, what you know most Americans would assume as a hunting rifle stock design. So they want that. They also want two dust covers. They want a dust cover to cover the magazine well when there's no magazine, yep, inserted, which is actually in the forward grip. It's like the heat guard on the bottom of the rifle, and you can fold it up and it'll secure off the magazine well. And then they also want a dust cover that's linked in with the charging handle, which is on the left side of the gun, that covers the ejection port. Because it's an open bolt system, when you charge the gun, the dust cover drops.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And you can push the dust cover back up, and when you pull the trigger, it will push it back down, and the round will be able to cycle out.
So you want to be able to keep dust out when you're in the right. Amber position.
They also changed the sights up just slightly to make the gun more user-friendly, basically. So basically, Poland's like, hey, we want this gun. They also wanted the blueprints and the rights to manufacture them in-house.
How'd that work out?
Well, FN said, yeah, we'll give it to you. But FN couldn't do that. They didn't have the rights to sell them that. Browning owned those rights. So they were promising Poland machining rights and blueprint rights, and they couldn't do it. So what ended up happening is because Colt had the import rights to Europe for guns, Browning had to give the guns to Colt to import into Belgium, and then for Belgium, specifically FN, to give those guns to Poland. It's basically like this whole, like, I'll scratch your butt and you sniff my butt and we'll be best friends at the same time. And we'll rape Poland.
So how much did Poland have to pay for these things? God damn.
You know, off the top of my head, I don't remember.
Even want to know. I don't even want to
know. I don't even remember, and I'll have to look it up later, and I'll give it to you guys on the next podcast. Right. I don't remember.
That'd be stupid expensive.
I don't remember how many guns Poland ordered, but I remember they got like maybe a third, if they were lucky, of the guns that they ordered. And they kept... Poland's like, hey, we need
full price, of course.
We need, right? And Poland was like, hey, we need the manufacturing rights. We need to do this in-house.
Yeah, right.
And FN was like, yeah, don't worry. We'll get it to you. So basically, all of a sudden, 1939 rolls around, and Germany's like, hey, what's up? You're Germany now, and we're going to take your country over. So the rumor is that the first shots fired by the Polish military ever to the Germans were with the WZ-28, which is... a 8mm Browning automatic rifle but piston driven. Literally, firearms design from the 240 Bravo has not changed. The only thing that 240 Bravo, which is a medium machine gun, crew served medium machine gun in the American military, as well as Belgium, because it's FN designed. The only thing that it incorporates to make it a better machine gun is the feeder paws and the feeder system from the MG42.
And I'd really only say the only reason it's a crew serve, if you want to get into argument's sake, is carrying ammo and tripod.
I mean, even then, the earlier 240 Bravos, they were still heavy gun systems.
Yeah,
They're lighter than the M60, lighter than the MG42, but still heavier than the M14.
Or the 249.
Right, yeah. That's getting further down the line. M249 squad automatic weapon, or the M249.
Any machine gun starting out really back then, everything was crew serve.
Well, sort of. So if you look at the 249, right? That's the BAR, literally the gas system.
Yeah,
it's the BAR bolt. It's literally the BAR bolt.
Scaled down.
It's just scaled down, right? The 240 Bravo, the BAR bolt. MG42, essentially the BAR bolt. The M60, BAR bolt. Literally every crew serve machine gun since after the BAR was invented in World War One is the BAR. It hasn't changed. Literally has not changed. Right? Now, there have been some differences where they reduce the amount of recoil so the bolt doesn't actually hit the back of the receiver. Right?
Those are minor technical things.
Right, but the bolt design is still the same.
This is what I was saying, where we're in kind of this slump where you're talking the difference between... I think before we even started this, we're talking the difference between, like... piston driven and jet driven.
You're talking about turbine versus piston.
Turbine versus piston driven
aircraft. It's still the same. It has been since the golden age of jets.
Yes.
And it hasn't changed. There's been nuances to update it, but it's been the same.
You know, we've got two basic systems, or in this case, in firearms, we've got like three systems.
Not including bolt guns.
Yes, I don't consider bolt guns really that because they're manually operated.
Fair enough.
I mean, that'd be like saying muzzle loaders.
Okay. Still around.
Well, I mean,
now we're getting like, let's nitpick everything.
Yeah,
by the way, archery's still around too.
Yeah, you know, let's not go too crazy here, but. But if you want to go into guns that kind of operate in mechanical means with moving parts, you're talking, we really only have 3 to 4 with the gas blowback systems. And I really don't even like that because, you know, I'm kind of, this is the conventional sniper podcast. And there's just systems that we really don't use all that much. Like recoil operated systems, blowback system. There's
like the Barrett.
Yeah, like
the Barrett serves its purpose when it needs to have a purpose.
Which is a
short recoil driven gun system where the barrel's reciprocating. But the problem with the Barrett is it's heavy.
Yeah,
and no sniper's like, hey, let me carry this fucking 20-pound 50-caliber gun.
And
up a freaking mountain.
And when I was your section sergeant, what was my rule about the Barrett?
It got broken down into two pieces, and you carried it that way. Or during tryouts, you carried the Barrett around just as a smoke session.
Yeah. If you didn't drop us off there, we didn't bring it.
Yeah.
Don't bring it.
if we're walking, we're not carrying a Barrett. If you're dropping us out of the back of a Bradley 100 yards from our final firing position, I'm bringing the Barrett.
Yeah.
And you better come back with some ammo because I'm not carrying that crap too.
Nope.
ounces equal pounds and pounds equal pain, brother.
We're not walking that son of a bitch nowhere.
Or like, I remember one time, I think this is just after you had gotten promoted and kind of moved out a section for a new job. I was with one of the other snipers, Gav specifically, and we did a night insert on a training op. And the back of the Bradley drops down, and the Bradley's going 10 miles an hour, and we're going to run out of the back of the Bradley. And some first sergeant was like, you boys bringing the Barrett? And I was like, want me to run out of the back of a Bradley at 10 miles an hour with a Barrett? Are you high right now? And he was like, I don't want to say this first sergeant's name over because I know he's a sergeant major right now.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, aren't you supposed to be the tough snipers? I was like, first sergeant, I'm going to set up a retrans site and do a reconnaissance to find this enemy armor column. You think that my Barrett is going to take out tanks? Are you high right now? Like, I need something to defend myself and shoot tank commanders off the top of tanks when they stick their heads out to check their maps. I'm not carrying a Barrett. Like, not at 10 miles an hour to the back of a Bradley.
Too
like, it's not happening.
Right. What was it? Too light to fight, too heavy to run.
Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly what it is. I'm not doing it. And he got kind of a little butthurt about it. But eventually I won my case. And Gavin and I did do an insert.
Bring in a 50 cal. What the fuck is Gavin, wrong with you? Yeah. No, are you bringing your own fucking missile launcher?
Why don't we just carry 20 mils up there? Screw it.
Yeah, like, no, what are you bringing in your rucksack?
Yeah, no, I'm not going to hang out in 20 degree weather for 4 or 5 days with a freaking Barrett that I ran out of the back of a Bradley.
Just because it looked cool.
Because it looked cool. Like, I'm not for doing you. It. Yeah, for you to put on your NCOER bullet. It's not happening, guy. So anyway, Gavin and I get up there, and we finally win our case, and the first round's like, fine, whatever, you can bring the 2010 and the 110s. And my argument was like, look, I'm going to call in artillery or other air support.
Like I said.
And just before bombs drop, I'm going to shoot every dude out in the open that I can and smack that ass. And then I'm cutting sing load and calling artillery in my own position once I get 100 yards away from it, because I'm going to desk my own position.
Like I taught you.
Like, I'm not going to stick around for this. I'm engaging an entire armored column. Like, I'm not going to use a Barrett. That'd be like, hey, shoot no. right here with your 120 millimeter.
No, you set up an artillery plan to include smoke screens. See, artillery is your favorite thing in the whole world. Let him be the king of battle. Have at it. Because you know what? They don't get to see it.
That's true. I do. I get to see the beautiful fireworks show.
When I get to say, hey, I need a linear smoke screen from point A to point B. I need this. I need this. I'm setting up the whole plan. I'm talking like I'm setting up this dinner party for all these people down there. And then when I say execute, when that first round starts coming in and I start going hot on that fucking
155
on that
radio, calling it and adjusting it.
Oh, you know, I got my RTO going hot on that radio, and then I've got my freaking shooter and my spotter going freaking hot, like, on the gun.
Gun's hot.
And then we freaking peel back. Oh, and the smoke comes in. They don't know where to shoot. Shit's going awry. Oh, God.
And it's like we were never even there. It's like Surf Pro. Like, never even happened.
I can't even give a BDA.
Because you're all dead.
Because, like, I'm not going to stick around for that
shit. So in this training, this is a training example, right? So, sure enough, the entire enemy column comes through a valley that Gav and I have eyes on. And I was just like, dude, I pitched a tent in my pants so big that Coleman himself would give me a heater. This thing was hot. And I called an artillery and I annihilated an entire brigade worth of armored column transports and tanks.
Did you head for 50 cal?
No, I didn't. Oh, that stupid thing in the tent. Goddamn first sergeants think they know everything. Anyway, so let's get back to the cartridge discussion.
Okay, sorry.
I digress. My bad, first sausage.
Too many beers.
Yeah. So cartridge selection. Let's talk about 6mm-ish. 6mm we know has been in circulation specifically with the Swiss since World War One.
Yeah, and the Swiss have been like under attack since like
the dawn of time.
Yeah.
So God, we know that like, we know six.
There's a shortage on snow.
Yeah, so 6mm. We know in the precision rifle world, 6.5 Creedmoor, 6mm or 6.5 PRC precision rifle cartridge is like the hottest of hot. But what people don't know is that 6mm actually converts to a non-metric size, which is.
All right, so 6mm, and we'll just start with 6, and then we'll go to 6.5. So 6mm is 2.43.
So 243
inches. And then you get the 6.5 is 2.64.
So 264. It's actually 0.264, not 2 point. It's 0.264 and 0.243.
Yeah. That. Listen to him.
This is why we don't do math in public.
This is why we don't do math when we're drunk.
I was just reading off what we have for notes, man.
Right? So, yes. Mind where you put your decimal point, because you're going to be off an entire grid.
This is why they make computer systems to help us with this.
Exactly, right. So, yeah. Anyway, 0.243 and 0.264, respectively, for 6mm and 6.5,
which if, respectively. If you're a hunter, you should recognize 243 Winchester.
Yeah, no, and those things are great rounds. I can't speak highly enough about 6mm. Honestly, my first gun was a 7mm Remington Magnum. Hot fucking round. Loved it. I've always been kind of leery about this, the 6mm. I was never really trained young. I was pretty much a trained to shoot in the military. And then greatly trained thereafter. But it really up until I studied ballistics, 6mm just really didn't come into my...
I knew from like reading up on history or listening to History Channel when I was a kid that the Swiss used a 6mm.
Yeah, but I mean...
I didn't understand...
Until you appreciate ballistics. So, I mean, once I got into... a sniper section. Once I started actually studying ballistics and looking at long range shooting, looking at the problems that you encounter between wind, you're going to have problems with
elevation.
elevation, you're going to have problems with.
Like just accuracy in general.
I mean,
lot number differences and grain weights, determining the difference
muzzle
between
velocities.
Like, yeah, muzzle velocities, what barrel lengths.
I could go into a dozen things. I mean, once you even got into reloading, that's when you start kind of paying attention.
Anyway. You know, this is why I don't reload. And to be honest with you, if you're getting into precision rifle, or even if you're getting into hunting, don't bother wasting your time right away with reloading.
No.
And here's why I actually don't reload for precision competition, is because let's say I reload 300 rounds of ammunition. Sure, it's going to be a little bit cheaper, and I can get every ounce of accuracy out of my barrel. But what if I get to a competition, and I need more than 300 rounds? Say I have a zeroing problem, right? And I waste 100 rounds trying to zero, which is absorbently a lot. However, pausing for a dramatic effect. If something is to happen, I don't bring enough ammunition, I just can't go to the store and pick up the ammo.
And
the reason why reloading started was because reloading was more accurate than what factory originally could produce 20 years ago.
Oh yeah.
But now factory ammunition is just as good as your reloaded ammunition.
It really is. And I would just say, when it comes to reloading, like, it's good to be able to reload your own ammunition. You can certainly tune, and I do reload, and I do reload ultra match grade for my own rifles, and I can really tune it in well. But there's so many nuances into it that unless you're really, really into, like, unless you've gotten past the point where your shooting is pristine.
Unless you're shooting specific bullseyes one thousandth of an inch means the difference between you winning and losing a competition. Hitting steel targets, a precision rifle, it's not going to matter. Walmart.
I'm just going to say, like, unless you're not even to the point where you're worried about your shooting and you just want to learn straight ballistics, and if you want to get into the point where, like, I know how to shoot, I want to learn flat ballistics at this point, then go ahead and reload. But
now the match grade ammunition from the factory is just as good.
But the point is, get on the range. Shoot match grade ammunition
If you go to a competition and you run out of ammo,
you're not gonna be
able to Walmart.
You're not gonna be able to outshoot it. I mean, there's most of the ammunition you get out there nowadays, whether it be from Cabela's, Bass Pro,
Walmart,
Pretty Trading Post, half of these other places,
Joe Schmo's gun shop.
You know, you can't outshoot that ammunition to begin with. So, practice shooting.
Which leads me back to my old comment about the last podcast. Go pick up a 22 trainer.
Yes, hands down. So,
you could get into nuances with 22. Like, there are guys that actually measure case diameter with 22. And if you take apart the grains of a 22, first off, you can't reload 22. Well, and second off, the 22 has like literally like one grain of powder in there. It's almost the point that it doesn't matter. It legitimately, it doesn't matter. Most of the powder charge comes from the primer.
When I ran the section, it was what, 4 months until I took you guys to the range?
During tryouts we went to the range. We did.
But I mean after tryouts.
Like on our own time?
It was a long time from when I took over to the time I actually started taking you guys to the range.
On our own time, maybe.
Section to the range with our sniper rifles.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because we were more concerned about the reconnaissance aspect, the camouflage and concealment. Because you can teach a monkey to shoot. You can't teach a monkey to shoot well. And they need to know all the data as well as the job of being a sniper before you get to the range.
And that's what I was about. And this is where I'm saying, like, the bullets don't matter. Like, if you don't know how the data and you don't know what you're doing with the gun, you don't know that. So this is fast forwarding to that. Now, forget about the bullets. If you don't know how to shoot, don't worry about how to make the bullets.
Right, yeah.
That's even beyond that point. Unless you can start stacking bullets at 1,000 yards, don't even start worrying about how to make your own bullets.
You need to.
That's just for shits and giggles.
It's not even about at 1,000 yards, but you need to understand the mechanical capabilities of your rifle. If your rifle is firing a cartridge, we'll say 22, that realistically has a maximum effective range of like 100 yards, and you can't shoot to 100 yards, don't go reload a cartridge that can shoot 100 yards because you haven't figured out how to do it from the factory.
And that's exactly what it is. It's just shooting or learning to shoot to the capability of what it is that you have purchased already. Furthermore, just learning where to spend your time. The time is spending it on the range, spending it appropriately. Look at your data book, your dope book. Oh, wait. We study dope books? Yes. Yes, we study the hell out of our dope books.
You collect the data of previous engagements. Dope.
So why do we study our data on previous engagements? Data on previous engagements. Dope.
It's a cumulative record of what you've previously engaged.
Because
environments change. Because environments change.
If it happened before, you can make it happen again.
Except for wind. The data is the elevation based on the atmosphere. It's not necessarily wind.
If the wind is the same, you can make it shoot the wind the same. It's just if all of the circumstances...
It reduces the margin of error.
If all of the circumstances are the same, you can do it the same. So once you start seeing patterns emerge, the more bullets you put down range, the more that you write into your dope book, the more data you will have, the more patterns you will see, the better shooter you will be. Look at your dope book, gentlemen and ladies and
everyone else.
Gunships.
Let's not forget our Apache attack helicopter genders. Anyway, hey, we appreciate you tuning in the podcast. We're not sorry that we've been drinking beer and podcasting.
Nope, not one damn bit.
So, as always, from the Tallgrass, one shot, one kill. Thanks for tuning in, guys.